Continuing with the greater discourse on the four establishments of life, we talked about the first, which is body, and the second, which is Vedana. Vedana only has the one practice, knowing pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, and distinguishing between with flesh and without flesh, however you interpret that. I think it's probably most useful to distinguish between the five sense Vedana and then the downstream reactions. Whatever sensory input comes in. The third establishment of mindfulness is mindfulness of citta. Citta is usually translated as mind. More accurately would be heart-mind. It's considered the organ of thinking and emoting. Pali, like many Asian languages, doesn't distinguish between thoughts and emotions. Mental activities, and the citta is the thing that does that, and it resides in the center of your chest. As we mentioned earlier, this is this excess marrow in your skull, right? But in the third establishment of mindfulness, really it's about mind states. I'll read you what it says. How does one abide contemplating mind states as mind states? Here, one knows a lustful mind as lustful, a mind free from lust as free from lust, a hating mind as hating, a mind free from hate as free from hate, a deluded mind as deluded, an undiluted mind as undiluted, a contracted mind as contracted, a distracted mind as distracted. A developed mind is developed, an undeveloped mind is undeveloped, a surpassed mind is surpassed, an unsurpassed mind is unsurpassed, a concentrated mind is concentrated, an unconcentrated mind is unconcentrated, a liberated mind is liberated, an unliberated mind is unliberated. So these are examples. This is not an exhaustive list. You may find some other mind state that doesn't fit this list. But the first are greed, hatred, and delusion. And these are the three fires, later misnamed in Mahayana's three poisons. That's not correct. The three poisons are alcohol, tobacco, and sugar. Okay. These are three fires. So, are you under the sway of one of these, of greed, hatred, and delusion, or are you free from it? Then we have contracted and distracted. The commentaries say contracted with sloth and torpor, distracted with restlessness and remorse. But, yeah, whatever it shows up for you. Developed and undeveloped, surpassed and unsurpassed, concentrated and unconcentrated. The commentaries say this is all about the jhanas. It's important for you to know, are you at access concentration or not? So you're actually doing third establishment of mindfulness when you're paying attention to whether you're at access concentration or not. And then a liberated mind is unliberated. The commentaries say that this is liberated from the hindrances, whereas I would think it would be, if it comes last, just fully liberated. That's pretty easy to check out. Are you experiencing any dukkha? If you are, you're not liberated. If there's been no dukkha, and it's been like that for a while, well, congratulations. That's pretty good. All right. So it's pretty simple. It's probably not a practice you want to do sitting here for an hour. I mean, you sit down, you go, not concentrated. Yeah, still not concentrated. Right? But it's really good to just check in periodically. Sit down and what is your mind state? Are you agitated? Are you relaxed? Just know what's your mind state when you sit down to meditate. When you get to the dining hall, you're standing in line there to get your food. What's your mind state? Are you impatient? Are you anticipating? anticipating, just check your mind state. Just check in frequently throughout the day. And of course, one does this internally and externally. So if you know the minds of others, you have that supernormal power, it's easy. But, you know, sometimes you can tell somebody's mind state. If they're making lots of loud noises with their mouth, shaking their finger, turning red, angry mind state, right? You can tell. And then arising and passing in relation to mind states. Notice how your mind state changes. You might investigate, why did it change? What was the trigger? There are infinitely many triggers out there, but it's kind of helpful to be able to identify. As Ayakema says, don't blame the trigger. It's just the trigger, right? But it's your mind state. And now it's in this way. Fairly simple practice, but hard to do because people forget to check in. But it's quite valuable, especially for what comes next in the fourth establishment of mindfulness. But before we do that, any questions on the third?
I find that when I do that, it can be quickly turned into judging.
Yeah, it's not about judging. It's about, okay, I'm angry. Right? How do I deal with anger? Right? And metta. That's how you start doing metta. We all, unless you're fully awakened, are going to have weird mind states. This is just what happens. And there's no point in adding any dukkha on top of that. If it's an unwholesome mind state, then what is there that you know to do to deal with the unwholesome mind state? If it's a wholesome mind state, yeah, keep it around, bring it to perfection. But the judging part just really isn't useful. We're all imperfect. I can tell. I don't get arahants on my retreat. I don't go on retreat, right? They already got it done. Hopefully they're teaching retreat someplace. You know, so we're all working to try and get, you know, ourselves to a better place. And we're all imperfect, so yeah, don't bother with the judging. So, all right, so I'm angry. Now I'm judging, right? Now I'm judging that I'm judging. I mean, we can really spin out on this. And it's just, the practice is just to recognize your state of mind. And then if something needs to be done about your state of mind, then do the thing. But you know, don't beat yourself up. The world will do that for you.
I understand hate and grief, but I don't understand delusion.
The delusion's tricky. You're deluded, it's about what's going on, actually. You're deluded about having a sense of self, or having a self. You have a sense of self, but you're deluded in that you think you have a self, and furthermore, it's the most important self in all of the universe. You might have run into a few people, maybe not in person, who have that delusion. Right? But you could be deluded about any number of things. You could be deluded that, oh, you have to work really hard on your meditation practice, whereas actually you got to be relaxed about doing it. But knowing that you're deluded, that's really difficult. It's probably only going to happen when you become undeluded, that you realize, oh, I was deluded about that. In other words, you gain some insight into something and you go, oh, that was delusion. You didn't know you were deluded about Santa Claus until you finally figured out there really wasn't a Santa Claus, right? And then you probably didn't go, oh, that was delusion. You probably went, am I still going to get presents? Right? But it's all like that. When you've actually got some mental construct that you've built up and it turns out not to be true, then you recognize, oh, I was deluded. And you also recognize now I'm undeluded, at least about that. But knowing that you're deluded when you're deluded is a really difficult thing. Yeah, if we could do that, we'd probably be a lot smarter, but we're caught in our delusion.
I'm just not really triggered.
Yeah. Okay, so you leave here and you happen to see a newspaper and you get really angry because the headline that you saw in the newspaper is about your least favorite politician doing something stupid again. Right? The politician was just the trigger. What you've got to work with is the anger. Your anger isn't solving the problem. The politician doesn't even know that you're angry. Right? It's your problem right now. And the problem is you're upset and you're angry and you're full of ill will and hatred or whatever has come up. And so it's not the trigger's fault. It's your reaction to the trigger. If you could see that headline and go, what did I expect? And not get angry, you're probably in a better place to do something about it. You know, sit down and write your congressman or whatever you do. Okay? So somebody says something to you and you don't like what they say. And so now you're mad at them. But really it's that you were unable to take what they said without getting upset. So why were you unable to take it? Did they touch a raw nerve? Did they say something that's true that you don't like about yourself? I mean, there's all sorts of ways to investigate. Or were they just deluded? You know, they said something and it's not true, and you know it's not true, and you just see, oh, this poor, pathetic, deluded person, as opposed to getting all angry and upset. So it's basically when you find yourself in a mental state that you find unpleasant, it's more about why are you having this reaction than what was it that made me have this reaction, the outside thing that did it. Isaiah Kama said, triggers are manifold.
If you notice you're having that reaction, like we were working yesterday with the vagrants, is it the best tactic to say, oh, unpleasant, right? My reaction to this is unpleasant. And if you can put it aside, is that enough to inquire? Or do you still go that extra step and say, I wonder why I had that unpleasant reaction?
It probably would depend on the circumstances. If it's while you're trying to get concentrated, yeah, just definitely.
Okay.
Anything you can set aside, that's perfect. But yeah. Maybe out in the world, you're not under a lot of pressure, you know, like, I should investigate this. Okay. But maybe you're in a meeting with your boss, and it's like not a really good time to go investigate. Just set it aside, you'll deal with it later. So it's really going to depend on circumstances. Yeah.
Where I tend to spin out is when I can't identify my.
That's difficult. I don't feel right, but I'm not sure why I feel this way, what it is, what's going on. Am I angry? Am I sad? Am I upset? Am I afraid? Yeah, that's tricky. Buddha never spoke about that, I don't believe. I think he just list a bunch of examples and say, what's going on with you. The things I can say, all right, we have the three fires, greed, hatred, and delusion. So if you encounter a mind state, is it one of these, all right? Is this mind state in response to wanting or not wanting, or confusion? You could say greed, hatred, and confusion, which may sort of, all right, this is an aversive reaction. And all aversion down at the very, very bottom has some sort of fear associated with it. I made this statement on a retreat one time. Somebody raised their hand and said, I hate broccoli, but I'm not afraid of it. Actually, you are. You're afraid that if you put it in your mouth, you'll experience unpleasant vagina. That's why you hate it. So, yeah, if it's an aversive state, there's some sort of fear behind it. It might be quite a few layers to get to that fear. So that's one thing to do if you can at least determine that the state is an aversive state. If it's a greedy state, there's something about the present that's not good enough. And if I can just get something more, so what is it about the present that's not good enough? Am I bored? Am I hungry? Am I whatever? It's all sorts of possibilities. And then confusion. Yeah, I don't understand what's happening. And so perhaps the first thing to do is to check out those three. And greed and hatred are just the names of the states, and they're more encompassing. Wanting, not wanting, you could say. And then delusion or confusion. Maybe confusion doesn't have quite the pejorative effect. It might be more willing to admit confusion than delusion. Does that help? Play with it and see. And yeah, I remember I'm just a computer programmer. So to tell you what the Buddha said, but I'm not that great with the psychological stuff. Yeah, but you might find somebody that does have psychological training and just bring that question up with them and see what they suggest.
You talk about greed, hatred, and delusion. Why is it not called greed, fear, and delusion?
I can't really say why it's not that. I don't know. I mean, did the Buddha understand that the hate is all based on fear? Or is hate just the most egregious form of this, and so that's the label they got put on it? The Buddha never talks about fear being at the basis of hatred, not that I know of. This was something that I came across on my own after 9/11. I mean, there were these people randomly attacking guys with turbans. Why on earth would they be doing something like that? They don't know the person. This person clearly wasn't involved. It's hatred. Why would they be expressing this? Because they're afraid. America was totally afraid at that point. Late September 2001, there was fear everywhere, and so people are lashing out of fear. And so I started examining my own self, and when there was hatred or something like that, it was like, okay, is there fear behind this? And that's what I kept finding. So I made the statement, and I got called on it for the broccoli. I recovered nicely.
Is greed not also based in fear? That not enoughness?
It can be. But it can also have a sense of, you know, yeah, there's not enough and I want more, but it doesn't have to be fear. It could be more boredom. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like.
That can also be fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, it all comes down to, I don't like the way things are, right? And what the Buddha is basically teaching you, there's a way to come to terms with the way things are and not have some sort of negative mind state with you. When I'm greedy, it's more out of boredom, and it's not so much fear. Okay, yeah, you can say, I'm afraid I'm going to be bored. I'm afraid I'm not going to be entertained. But that doesn't really get to the heart of it there. I can see the gnawing. I want more entertainment. Sort of thing. And so it's more the I want. I think if we looked at it neuroscientifically, the hatred, all that's going on in the amygdala, which is sort of right in the center of your brain, is a very old structure, and that's activated when you get the hate and the fear part. Whereas the wanting part is other parts of the brain that are activated. So from a neuroscientific standpoint, I think it would be somewhat different.
We're just thinking of fear of self. You know,
yeah, that could certainly be
becoming
there. Right. This isn't good enough. I've got to get something more to make me better. Yeah, that could certainly be there. And, you know, whatever I say here is just sort of general. And there's a famous saying, no generalization is worth a damn, including this one. Right? So, yeah, your mileage may vary. You know, investigate and see what's going on with your mind state.
Can I ask
two
questions?
Ask them one at a time, so I don't have to remember them.
First one, how does degree five relate to the five hindrances?
So the three fires are our basic tendencies, and then they manifest when we're trying to meditate as the five hindrances. Okay, so the first hindrance and greed obviously go together, the second one and hatred go together. The boredom, that could be arising from any of these. The sloth and torpor could be arising from any of these. It could be arising because you're lazy, and you're lazy because you're deluded and you don't realize you've got work to do. Right? It could be arising because you're physically tired. Okay, so then it wouldn't necessarily be arising from this. It could be arising because you're deluded about something else. So generally the sloth and torpor, if it relates back to one of the fires, is delusion. The restlessness could be for any of the three. You're restless because you just want something. You're restless because you're averse to something. I think I mentioned that I discovered that if I was sitting and I began to get a bit uncomfortable, not so uncomfortable that I needed to move, but it was uncomfortable enough to make me restless. And my mind was restless because it didn't want to look at the discomfort. And so that was aversion. And then the restlessness can show up out of delusion of, you know, I just move around a little bit more, I'll get it perfect. Or if I just think about this or whatever, instead of recognizing, yeah, I don't need to think about anything, I'm trying to get concentrated. And then doubt can arise for all three of them as well. So they're sort of like the bottom stuff. There's also the asavas and how they fit in there. I've forgotten the order between the asavas and the fires. But again, the hindrances grow out of those, and that's of our meditation. And your second question?
My second one is about what you had said last night. You talked about how to get the mindfulness in between the Vedas.
Yeah, between the Vedana and the craving.
Yeah. And I was wondering, can you also notice sense and then the Vedana? Like, is it possible to get the mindfulness in between the sense?
I've been able to do it, but only coming out of the higher jhanas. So it's not real practical out there in the world, right? It just goes so quick. I found, get on retreat, get to eighth jhana, and then sit there, and I could actually experience the sound, and just literally a fraction of a second later, the judgment of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral with the sound. But I had to be supremely concentrated, because you got 1/10 of a second. That's hardly anything at all. Whereas after the pleasant, you actually have the potential to have quite a few seconds before the greed sets in, because it's going to be the sanya, the conceptualizing what this sensory input is, and then you start thinking about it. And then you get to the I want as you've thought about it and decided. So if you just notice the Vedana, then you're thinking about it, it maybe won't go into the I want and you get the greed. And the same for the unpleasant, it maybe won't go into the I hate it, I want it to go away. Okay, no hands up, time to move on. All right. So that's the only practice given under the third establishment of mindfulness. And both the Vedana practice and the mind state practice were in the original Satipatthana Sutta. So we had the body parts, and we did it as a body scan. So the parts of the body, the Vedana, and states of mind. Fourth foundation of mindfulness, fourth establishment of mindfulness is dharmas. And as I said, dharma gets used in different ways. Here it's being used more as phenomena, but it's phenomena with respect to the dharma. So dharmas with respect to the dharma. And the first one that's given is the five hindrances, which is another one of the original ones. I'll read you what it says. How does one abide contemplating phenomena as phenomena? Here, one abides contemplating phenomena as phenomena with respect to the five hindrances. And how does one do so? Here, if sensual desire is present in oneself, one knows it is present. If sensual desire is absent in oneself, one knows that it is absent. And one knows how unarisen sensual desire comes to arise, and one knows how the abandonment of arisen sensual desire comes about. And one knows how the non-arising of the abandoned sensual desire in the future will come about. If ill will and hatred, if sloth and torpor, if restlessness and remorse, if doubt is present, one knows it's present. If a hindrance is absent, one knows it's absent. If one knows how an unarisen hindrance comes to arise, and one knows how the abandonment of an arisen hindrance comes about, and one knows how the non-arising of the abandoned hindrance in the future will come about. Okay, so first, you're doing third establishment, checking in with your mind state, right? And then you discover, oh, there's a hindrance happening, right? All right, so you've discovered it's there. You can check in while you're meditating and discover, yeah, no hindrances. That's very good. But you discover one's there. All right, so you've discovered it's there. Now you want to know, how did it come to arise? What brought on this hindrance? What is it? You might find it helpful to identify the trigger, just don't blame the trigger. See what got you into this pickle. Then one knows how the abandonment of the hindrance comes about. So what are you going to do with the fact that this hindrance has arisen? Okay, if it's sense desire, then you're going to see the flaws, the less than perfect of whatever it is you're desiring, or however else you want to work with it. Eat less food at lunch. If it's ill will and hatred, then it's metta, etc. We talked about the six things to do, overcome each of these hindrances. And then you're going to understand how in a future situation you're not going to fall into this hindrance. Right? So you figured out how you got there, you figured out how you got out, and then you figure out how when you get into a similar situation that got you into it this time, you're going to counteract that situation and not fall into it. We've talked a fair amount about the hindrances already. Any questions on this as a practice?
Do you see this as an illustration of dependent origination?
Yes, our hindrances are dependently originated. So why did it arise? What did it arise dependent upon? Is it the fact that somebody sneezed in the room and you got upset because they were disturbing your high samadhi, right? All right. So your upset is a dependently originated phenomena. Okay. Why did you get so upset about that? Oh, I'm craving and clinging access concentration and they just messed it up. Well, no, I messed it up because I got upset. I didn't just let the sneeze go. I just should have just let it, see it backed it off a little bit and let it go. But because I really wanted this and I'm very attached, it produced dukkha. Well, maybe I shouldn't react so strongly the next time somebody sneezes. Something like that. And so you're seeing the dependently originated nature.
You mentioned the fourth effort, what comes after the arising?
So this prevent, so this figure out how it arose, figure out how to get it to go away, and prevent, and figure out how to prevent it from coming back in the future. So the four efforts, it's really just the first two efforts.
Mm-hmm.
It's how to make what's there go away, and then the thing you did before you made it go away was figure out how you got there. Using that information, you figure out the second, how to prevent it from arising in the future. So it's really the first two of the four great efforts. We'll get to the last two when we get to the seven factors of awakening. The four great efforts to make an arisen unwholesome state go away, to prevent the arising of an unarisen unwholesome state, to make a wholesome state that hasn't arisen to arise, and to make an arisen wholesome state stick around and come to perfection. So that's the four great efforts. And we're using the first two of those in dealing with the hindrance. One, of course, does it internally, externally. Sometimes you see your friend under the influence of hindrance. Right? How did they get themselves into this pickle? Maybe I shouldn't, you know, do what they did. It didn't work. So the next one is the five khandhas. Khandha is Pali. Skanda is Sanskrit. It's often translated as the five aggregates. The word really means heap or pile. So if you were to see a cord of firewood, it would be a khanda of firewood, a heap of firewood. If you see a pile of rocks, a pile of sand, it's a khanda of rocks or a khanda of sand. The firewood one is really important because our three fires, guess what the fuel for those three fires are, right? It's the five. So, what are they? Again, one abides contemplating phenomena as phenomena with respect to the five aggregates of grasping, the five upadana khandhas. It's a little tricky to translate this. Upadana is the word we translate as grasping, and khandha is aggregate. So the five grasping aggregates, except that the aggregates don't grasp. The aggregates are grasped after. Except, it's another pun. Upadana also can mean blazing. At the time of the Buddha, the fire clung to its fuel, right? So upadana could mean blazing. So the five blazing aggregates, blazing with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, how does one do so? Here, one thinks, such is form, such is the arising of form, such is the disappearance of form. Such are Vedana, such is the arising of Vedana, such is the disappearance of Vedana. Such is conceptualization, or perception, such is the arising of conceptualization, such is the disappearance of conceptualization. Such are the mental activities. Such are the arising of mental activities, such as the disappearance of mental activities. Such as consciousness, such as the arising of consciousness, such as the disappearance of consciousness. So sometimes you hear it said that these are the five categories the Buddha divided the psychophysical world up into, sort of a metaphysical statement. But I think it's much more accurate to say, these are the five ways that we experience the world. Right? We experience the world as a world of objects. Right? That's form. It's a table. That's what we call it. But it's form. It's got material object. And then we experience Vedana, which we've talked about. We take our sensory input and using the Vedana as this, not conscious. then identify what the sensory input is. We conceptualize it. So it's a table, obviously, right? Well, not if you're a leprechaun. If you're a leprechaun, it's a bus shelter, right? And if you're in desperate need of firewood, it's firewood. And if there's a flood and it comes floating past, it's a life raft, right? The conceptualizing is something that we are doing based on the situation. There is no absolute concept. This is what the Buddha is saying. It's sort of like absolute pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's not under your control. But the conceptualizing is all based on both the sensory input, your language. In English, we don't have a word that translates to mudita. You don't have that concept if you speak English, unless, of course, you start studying Buddhism, and then you get the concept of empathetic joy or appreciative joy. So your concept is very much dependent on what you're experiencing. You hear a doctor or a lawyer speaking in their jargon, or a computer programmer. You know, it's concepts that they're throwing at each other, and it doesn't make any sense to you because you don't have those concepts. We then take the concepts and we basically string them together to make our mental activities, our thoughts, our emotions, our memories, our intentions. Okay? And then there's just basic knowing. We call that consciousness. There's also self-consciousness, being aware that there is an entity here, which I call me, that is having these experiences. Now, the Buddha says that sense contact involves three things. There's the object, right? So the form or the sound, right, which is made by some form out there, right? Or the smell, or the taste, or the texture, right? Or the thought. Let's work with the five senses first. So this form out there, and then there's a sense organ. And the sense organ and the object come together along with sense consciousness. And the three of these is contact. Right? So consciousness actually comes in very early in the way that we work with senses. It's given as the last one in this list, but it really comes in when we have a sense contact very early in the process. We could say that consciousness is that which knows. For example, look up here at this fixture, this light fixture. Stop taking your notes and look at the light fixture. All right, stare at it really carefully. All right. Now become aware of what's in your peripheral vision. Well, you became aware of in your peripheral vision was there all along, but you weren't conscious of it when I was telling you to stare at the light fixture. Right? It was only when I directed your consciousness that you became aware of the window or the wall or whatever it is in your peripheral vision. Right? So consciousness is the part of your mind that actually knows what's happening. But for it to know anything, it needs the sensory input of a sense object, a sense organ, and the sense consciousness. Right? So that happens first. That's contact. That's immediately followed by the vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And then that's followed fairly quickly by identifying what it is. The vedana is just automatic and it's right there. No, totally under your control. The sanya, the conceptualizing what you're seeing, may actually take a few seconds. I love going for a walk in the woods and seeing something and not being able to identify exactly what I'm seeing. And watching my mind churn as it tries to figure out, oh, it's just some mushrooms or whatever it is. But during that couple of seconds where I haven't been able to identify it, it's really interesting to watch how the mind is doing this. And it's really struggling. And once I do identify it, I can't unsee it as mushrooms. I can't go back to seeing it as unknown. It's mushrooms now, and it's just stuck as mushrooms, right? So basically, the conceptualizing sort of hardens whatever the sensory input is. And then we string our concepts together to make our mental activities. I'm basically teaching you by getting some thought in my mind, and I take that thought and break it up into the concepts called words, and then I vibrate some loose stuff in my throat and throw some vibrations out to you, which you then take into your ear, which vibrates, and hopefully turns into the similar words and the similar concepts, and you string them together to get a similar thought to the one that I have. This is how we communicate. Right? We're throwing bits of Sanya at each other, right, and stringing them together to make the concepts. And so when we string them together, that's sankhara. And sankhara in this context is best translated as mental activity. And so if I bring up a memory of, say, your first grade teacher, right, there were probably multiple words that came to mind right then. Maybe the name, maybe what the teacher looked like, maybe they were kindly, maybe they were stern, right? So all these concepts came up. And so I threw the concept first grade teacher at you using sub-concepts first grade teacher, right? And you strung them together to get a bigger concept, and then you got a lot more in terms of a memory of your first grade teacher. And it's the same thing with all your thoughts and emotions. You're making together, you're making the concepts come together to give you the thought or the emotion or the intention or whatever mental activity there is. And then consciousness shows up again. If it's complex enough, the thought maybe is about me, and now there's self-consciousness. These aggregates are, well, you could say that they are an order of complexity. The table has form. I don't think it has vapor. Right? I can knock on it, and it's not going to care. Right? But the plants, they respond to the sunlight. They like Beethoven better than acid rock. The amoebas run to the food. They run away from the salt. So living organisms have an ability to respond positively and negatively towards their environment. That's what it means to be alive. So even the simplest life is responding. So it's got vedana, although maybe pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is a little too anthropomorphic. Then as life gets more complex, it has the ability to categorize. Your dog knows the sound of the can opener, right? It recognizes that, and it knows this is going to be food, and it comes running into the kitchen. Okay, so we get organized enough, and they're concepts of some sort. And then eventually, there gets to be even more to where, I don't know if your dog actually thinks about things, but there's more going on there than going on in an amoeba, right? At some level, it gets fairly complex of thoughts, emotions, whatever. Certainly amongst, say, the great apes, we see emotions there. Dolphins, whales, there seem to be emotions happening there. And then if the organism is complex enough, it recognizes itself. I remember a cat that my family had. There was a large mirror that was just sitting on the floor, and the cat walked up and looked in the mirror, and then went behind the mirror, and came out and looked again, and played with the cat, and went behind the mirror, never figured out that it was itself. Yet, the great apes, dolphins, whales, and ravens can recognize themselves. So then it's so complex. The mental processing has gotten so complex, there's self-recognition going on. So these are the five aggregates. I want to share a sutta with you that maybe gives a little more information of why this is so important. This is from the Middle Length Discourses. It's Sutta 109, the Greater Discourse on the Full Moon Night. At the time of the Buddha, on the new moon and the full moon, the monks would all sit up all night and meditate. It's India, you know, in the summertime it's 120 degrees. Not real great for meditating. But at night it cools off and it's only 100 or something, right? So much better to meditate then. And so the tradition develops on the full moon and the new moon. They sit up all night. On that occasion, a monk arose, raised his hands in reverential salutation, and said, "I would ask the Blessed One about a certain point." The Blessed One says, "Sit on your seat and ask your question. Venerable Sir, are these the five aggregates affected by clinging? That is, material form, vedana, conceptualizing, mental activity, consciousness." "Yes." "Good, Venerable Sir. In what are these five aggregates affected by clinging rooted? Why do they get affected by clinging? What are they arising? What is that arising dependent on? These five aggregates affected by clinging are rooted in desire." We had that independent origination. Clinging arises from craving or desire, which is often used synonymously, especially in this particular discourse. "Venerable Sir, is that clinging the same as the five aggregates, or is it something apart from the five aggregates?" "Bhikkhu, that clinging is neither the same as, nor is it apart from the five aggregates. It is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates that there is clinging." So these are the objects of our desire and lust. This is what we want. "But Venerable Sir, can there be diversity in the desire and lust regarding these aggregates?" "There can be. Here someone thinks, may my material form be thus in the future, may my vedana, my conceptions, conceptualizations, my mental activities, my consciousness be different in the future." There's some variety there. "But Venerable Sir, in what way does the term aggregate apply to the aggregates? Any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the material form aggregate." And then it repeats for each of the others. These categories, far, near, gross, subtle, etc. "Venerable Sir, what is the cause and condition for the manifestation of each of these aggregates?" "Bhikkhu, the four great elements are the cause and condition for the manifestation of the material form aggregate." So material form is solids, liquids, gases, and energy. "Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of vedana." Right? We already had that independent origination. Vedana arises dependent on sense contact. "Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of conceptualization." Right? There's contact, there's the vedana, but then arising after that, there's the conceptualizing of the sense contact. "Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the mental activities aggregate." We think and emote and remember based on our sensory input. We get some sort of sensory input and we process it, basically. And we have thoughts and emotions and intentions and so forth. And then nama rupa is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the consciousness aggregate. this again, we had independent origination last night, that consciousness arises dependent on mind and body, is usually how it's put, independent origination. Venerable sir, how does identity view come to be? Okay, this is why this stuff is important. Here, bhikkhus, an untaught, ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones and is unskilled in their and undisciplined in their dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dhamma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form, or regards vedana, consciousness, vedana perception, mental activities, consciousness, as self, or self as possessed of, or in self, or self in. And this is how we make up ourselves, right? If I say to you, I'm sick, well, actually my body is sick, but now I am my body when I say I am sick. Right? If I say this is my arm, now I'm possessed of this arm. I'm not identified, I'm not my arm. I'm the owner of the arm. Right? We sometimes think of self as inside of our body. I am behind my eyes looking out. Right? We don't usually think of the body as inside myself, but we do think of our thoughts as being inside of ourselves. Our concepts are inside of ourselves. My consciousness is inside of me, right? Sometimes we'll identify, I am my consciousness. Our thoughts, we don't usually identify, think, I am my thought. My thought is inside of me, right? I'm going to keep my thoughts to myself inside. You can't see them, right? So we relate to these five aggregates as either the same, or we own them, or they're in me, or I'm in them. We just change amongst these all the time. I stubbed my toe. I hurt. I'm miserable. This pain is terrible. So I went from owning the toe to I hurt, where it's my body that hurts. Now this is terrible. This is a thought inside of me. I've identified with it. I feel horrible. We're just swapping as to who we think we are, how we're identifying it, just without regard to, oh, I should stop identifying with my body. No, I'll identify with my thought or my emotion. Right? We don't ever do that. We just swap as though it's perfectly natural. We never really catch on to making this up as we go along. Venerable sir, how does identity view not come to be? Here, a well-taught, noble disciple who has regards for noble ones, and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their dhamma, doesn't do that. Doesn't regard any of these aggregates as me, or me possessing, or in me, or me in them. What, venerable sir, is the gratification, what is the danger, and what is the escape in the case of each of these aggregates? So, the Buddha agrees that there is gratification to be found in the aggregates. But there's also danger. There's escape. The pleasure and joy that arises dependent on an aggregate, this is the gratification in regards to that aggregate. Right? So, yeah, there's definitely pleasure and joy out there. You're going to go eat lunch and you're going to have some pleasure and joy on your plate. Right? These are impermanent. Dukkha and subject to change. This is the danger. going to eat your lunch, and if it didn't give you enough pleasant vedana, you're going to go back for seconds, right? And it's all gone because everybody else ate up for seconds, and now you experience vedana, right? Or you didn't get enough pleasure, but you're not going back for seconds because you've got discipline, and now you're getting unpleasant vedana because you want it, and you're not allowing yourself to have it, right? This stuff changes. It's not going to give lasting satisfaction. And, you know, eventually you're going to get hungry again. It doesn't matter how much food you eat. At some point, you're going to get hungry again. It's not like you can say, well, I'm going to go on a retreat. I'm going to eat 10 days worth of food before I leave. It doesn't work that way, right? None of this is ultimately satisfying. It changes. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for each of these aggregates, this is the escape. Right? So, there's the food, right? You like it, you don't like it, whatever, you eat it, it does what it needs to do, and that's it. You just leave it there. If it was pleasant, you enjoyed it. If it wasn't pleasant, it was probably nutritious. You just don't get lost in craving for things to be other than that, what they are. So this is the problem with these aggregates. They do give us pleasure. They don't give us lasting pleasure. And when they don't give us lasting pleasure, we get upset about that and experience dukkha. And basically what the Buddha says is, yeah, they don't give you lasting pleasure. Don't get lost in desire and lust around these aggregates. Well, sir, how does one know, how does one see, so that in regard to this body, with its consciousness and all external signs, there's no I-making, mind-making, and underlying tendency to conceive? Conceive means conceive of the self. So how should we behave such that we don't go identifying with these aggregates and making a self? Me too. Any aggregate, whatever, whether past or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one sees all these aggregates as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, my atta, my little kernel of essence that someday is going to be eternally happy. These aggregates, they change. It can't be your eternally happy self. So it's for all of these aggregates. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not my soul. Then in the mind of a certain bhikkhu, this thought arose. So it seems material form is not self. Vedana is not self. Perception is not self. Mental activities are not self. Consciousness is not self. What self, then, will actions done by the not-self affect? Right? So, if these aren't self, and I do some action, who gets the karma? Right? Often it's expressed, if there's not a self, who gets reborn? Or what gets reborn? Then the Blessed One, knowing in the mind the thought of that bhikkhu, addressed the bhikkhus thus. It is possible, bhikkhus, that some misguided man here, obtuse and ignorant, with his mind dominated by craving, might think that he can outstrip the teacher's dispensation thus. So it seems that each of these aggregates is not self. What self, then, will actions done by the not-self affect? Now, bhikkhus, you have been trained by me through interrogation on various occasions in regard to various things. There's a footnote. The readings of this sentence are highly divergent in different editions. The same sutta appears in the Samyutta Nikaya, And the reading there seems preferable to the reading here. The translation here follows the Semyutic text. Vipunana Moli's translation, based on a different version of the Pali from, I believe, Sri Lanka rather than, I'm not sure, a different version. Now, bhikkhus, you have been trained by me in dependence, dependent conditionality in various instances. Maybe a little clearer? Neither version is idiomatic Pali, and the commentaries to both Nikayas are silent. Okay, what the Buddha is saying is, bhikkhus, I've taught you dependent origination. I've taught you, basically, that if you really get the dependent origination teachings, you won't go asking who questions. You won't go conceiving of a self. You'll see that there's nothing but streams of dependently arising processes interacting. There are no entities to be found. We'll get to this in detail. Right? So I think right here what the Buddha is doing is referencing the sutta we're going to talk about tonight. And then what follows is basically about half of the so-called second discourse, the discourse on not-self. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent dukkha or sukha? Dukkha, Venerable Sir. Especially if you take dukkha to be not a source of lasting happiness. Right? That's an interesting translation. It seems to work better here. Is what is impermanent a lasting source of happiness or not a lasting source of happiness? Not a lasting source of happiness, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent, dukkha, and subject to change, get to be regarded, this is mine, this I am, this is myself, my soul. Oh, Venerable Sir. And the same for each of these aggregates. They're impermanent, they're not a source of lasting happiness. It's not fit to be regarded as something that I can really possess, because it's going to change and it's going to be gone. It's not really me, and it's not my soul. It's not the essence that's going to be eternally happy. That's what we're looking for. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form, whatever, for the past, future, or present, etc., all material form should be seen as it is, actually with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And the same for each of the other aggregates. Seeing this, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with vedana, disenchanted with conceptualizing, disenchanted with mental activities, disenchanted with consciousness. The word disenchanted should be understood as disenchanted. We are now enchanted by material forms, vedana, concepts, our mental activities and consciousness. We're under the spell. We're under the spell that this is me, this is going to give me happiness, etc. When one sees these things as they really are, the spell is broken and one becomes disenchanted. Being disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. Dispassion is a translation of the Pali word viraga, not raga. Raga means originally to color. You might be familiar with the Indian musical form of raga. It's called a raga because it's going to color your mind. Graffiti would be a raga, right? And so, if you're enchanted, your mind might be colored by what you're enchanted by. For example, you're walking down the street and you see somebody wearing the colors of the enemy team. Your mind is so colored by support for your own team, right? because you're enchanted by identifying with these grown men playing a child's game, right? But now you see somebody else wearing the enemy team, right? And your coloring is so bad that you have a terrible opinion of this person. You don't even know them. Just they're wearing the wrong kind of hat and jacket. So think of a toy that you had as a kid that if you had lost that toy, you'd have been really upset. Right? Your mind was colored by that. And now you even know where that toy is. When was the last time you played with it, if you do know where it is? I mean, it might be in some box, you know, on the upper shelf of your closet or something, but you no longer have that passion for it. It no longer colors your mind. Right? So by breaking the spell, becoming disenchanted, your mind is no longer colored by being attached and lost in these five aggregates. Through dispassion, one's mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. One understands, birth is ended, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there's nothing further here. This is what the Blessed One said. Bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now, while this discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, the minds of 60 bhikkhus were liberated from the asava. I guess the Buddha had a better delivery. Okay, so these are the five aggregates. These are basically how we're experiencing the world, either as forms, as vedana, concepts, mental activities, and consciousness. We get enchanted by these, we identify with them, we lust after them, but they're impermanent. They're a source of dukkha when they change. And what the Buddha says is, see them for what they are, don't get lost.
I wanted you to read that summary of what we're supposed to do, just in case, you know. Right at the end, it was.
It's what is usually referred to as the victory cry of the Arahant. One understand, birth is ended, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there's nothing further here. Okay? So the first order of business is do what has to be done. Investigate reality. Gain enough insight such that you don't do the craving and clinging anymore. Right. Other questions are coming. It's 109 in the Middle Length Discourses, MN 109, and the name of it is The Greater Discourse on the Full Moon Night. A condition, not the condition.
Yeah, all right. So, like this, the space between or the of working with aversion versus developing concentration.
Right.
Body scan, body concentrated, sound, contact. So, I get that any more than that is a made up story about why the sound shouldn't be happening.
Right.
But my attention has still gone.
Yeah, bring it back.
Is there like one little thing in between? Because it's hard to just, maybe I just have to get better at it, but it's just bring it back.
So you could label it sound or distraction and then relax and bring it back.
To me, in that is what helps me is just that, like, little stuff like that. This is hard.
Yeah, this is hard.
Yeah, because the sound is hard for me.
Right, yeah.
This is hard. Come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Another question. Comment on the aggregate.
Can you say more about how to think about Sankara in relation to Sanya? At one level, you can think about it as a string of perceptions. Sankara as a string of perceptions.
String of
concepts. It must be more than that.
Yeah.
Concept.
Right.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have a separate word for it.
Right.
Or is it just that when you see a sankara really clearly, it breaks into those different samas and that's the end of it?
Well, so start thinking about what your mental activities are. So a thought, right? Retreat's about halfway over. So there's a concept of retreat, and there's a concept of half, and there's a concept of over, right? And we put those concepts together. Now, the sum is greater than the individual parts, right? If I say, over, retreat, halfway. You know, it doesn't have the same thing as the retreat's halfway over. Right? So we put it together in this form. We've got syntax, and you know, we get a new concept of it. I get on the stick or whatever. But that the thought is really made out of concepts. The emotion. I'm sad. Why am I sad? Well, that was terrible. Okay, so this concept's in there, we've made this last experience sort of summed up into sad, right? Memory, first grade teacher, Ms. Edwards, little short thing, walked with a limp, really sweet. Her husband was a science teacher in high school. All of this comes back when first grade teacher. There's a lot of concepts there. Your intentions. When the bell rings, I'm going to go back to my room and I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to go get some food. And I probably should get a lot of salad. You know? I really do need my brain. Those are all concepts that we're stringing together, right? So it would appear that we make our mental activities, our thoughts, emotions, intentions, memories, out of a bunch of concepts we string together. But when we string them together, we get something bigger than just the words one after another, just the concept one after another. They come together to make something quite a bit bigger.
In terms of practice, is the recommendation, if you're working with the sankara, break it down into perceptions, or is there a way in which you're trying to stay with it in the gestalt form, if you're focusing on sankara?
Right. I would say break it down into concepts, not perceptions, because perception, I wish they hadn't used that word to translate Sanya, because perception, I perceived it as cooler today, right? But now it's really about the concept of cooler. So you could break the sankara into its concepts, but there are other ways to work with them as well. So it's not like you only have one way to work with them. So yeah, any way that you can investigate and see what's really going on there, they go for it. But one thing you can definitely do is break it into it, the concepts that make it up, to give you some idea of what's going on. But that's not the only one. They're not written visible on this retreat. They're in my Kindle. They're on my website. Yeah. Are they on my website? Yeah, I think I posted them just recently on my website. Where did I post them? If you can't find them on my website, let me know. I think they're probably posted. If you click the schedule, click my name, click printer-friendly versions. Probably is probably a printer. friendly version of them. Because somebody recently asked for a printout of them.
Leads to a bigger question about, well, reading a lot of information. I'm not going to remember it all. Do you think that most of it is on your website, or is there an outline of this retreat someplace?
So there's, again, click the schedule, click my name, and then under that there's the titles of the Dharma talks. If you click that, it's whole bunch of Dharma talks, some of which I won't give on this retreat, but for each of them, it's the title, and then there are the sutta references. And then if you go go to the website, click the Buddha, and towards the bottom of the little menu thingy there, it says talks, and if you click on that, and then you click on audio Dharma, you'll find most of the talks on audio Dharma. From a retreat I did at Gaia House in 2012, something like that. There are various places where there are copies of the talks, so if you want to listen to one of the talks again. You know, most teachers have hundreds of talks. You know, I got 24. Yeah. You just get the stuff over and over again because, yeah, nobody's going to remember it all. And then hopefully I learn something new, so if you sit with me again, I'll give the same talk, but I'll learn something new, and it'll be slightly different, hopefully.
And you wrote a book.
And I wrote a book, so the jhana stuff, yeah, is in the book, but the dependent origination
book,
stuff, not yet.
You were considering of putting your Dharma talks into a second book. Is that an active project, or...?
The word active would be quite a stretch. So I'm working on a book, and working as a stretch, on dependent origination. And so last night's talk, in an earlier version, is in the manuscript, is a transcript of that. So there's some stuff in there. I'm a computer programmer. I write for consumption by computers. Writing for consumption by humans is a lot of work. And so I haven't done much work on it lately.
Just want to know.
Wait 6 minutes until noon. Do not rush to the dining hall and enjoy your lunch. So, one interviews continue.
Just a reminder to remember to always be as quiet as you can in this house. There's going to always be somebody.